Hey, howdy, hey, what's going on?
What's up? Your favorite Star Wars bitches back in the house again.
Yep, just a quick shout out. Happy Life Day for everyone who celebrates. That's like Star Wars Christmas.
I literally was about to say, what the hell is Happy Life Day?
Yeah, Life Day. It's there is a very cursed holiday special that came out in the 80s late 70s early 80s, and it basically tells the story about how there's a holiday in the Star Wars universe called Life Day, and it's the story takes place with Chewie's family on Kashyyyk. So like Chewie has like a wife and kids and like in-laws and stuff, like Chewie is at, so his family is at the house. And they're waiting for the characters from the Star Wars movies because they're coming to the house to celebrate Life Day. So then you get, Mark Hamill is in it as Luke Skywalker. And, like, he's got, like, the worst makeup job that has ever existed in television. And, yeah, like, it was pretty significant world building for that time. But then George Lucas hated it so much that he basically kept it hidden from society, like didn't do reruns or anything. And then with the like emergence of the internet, it kind of came back to the point that finally Disney now was like, all right, we'll release it. So they released it.
All right. So tell me, The Force Awakens.
So there's some really interesting like history and context revolving around The Force Awakens, because there's some drama around just its creation and what it signifies. Because this movie came out in December 2015, and this was the first Star Wars project released under Disney. So Disney had acquired Lucasfilm in 2012 from George Lucas for a sale of like $4 billion. So like kind of cheap if you really think about like the value of the Star Wars brand. But George Lucas at that time like was about to get married, and him and his future wife were planning to have a kid via surrogate. So he was kind of like, he was working on the Clone Wars show because that came out in 2008, and then Indiana Jones, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out in 2008. So he had been busy.
Excellent film.
Yeah, excellent film. People don't know what they're missing. But he kind of at that point was like, you know, I'm getting old. I kind of just want to like disappear and raise my kids. So Disney acquired Lucasfilm in 2012. And they pretty much immediately announced that they were working on a sequel trilogy. Now, this relationship with Disney actually started in 1986 because Lucasfilm at Industrial Light and Magic worked on Captain EO.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So that
okay.
was like the first partnership they had. And due this to the success of Captain EO, then they started kind of talking, and they were like, you know, we would be interested in maybe doing like a Star Wars themed attraction. And so in 1987, Star Tours opened at Disneyland in California. And then pretty much quickly after that, like one opened in Hollywood Studios in Florida, one at Tokyo Disney.
Been there.
Hell yeah. And one more at another park. So, I mean, very quickly gained popularity in 1997. At the time, MGM Studios in Florida started doing Star Wars weekends. So pretty much like May and June would just be for Star Wars. And like cast would come and do like photo ops and autographs, and there'd be like walk around characters. And so that kind of tied in really well with, of course, the prequel trilogy coming out in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then leading up to Clone Wars coming out in 2008. So it definitely, like, was a very popular event. And it wasn't until 2012 where, at this point, Clone Wars is entering its fifth season, and it's planning for a sixth and seventh. And Cartoon Network, who was doing Clone Wars at the time, then started having, like, a lot of weird contract issues. So it kind of just made sense once Clone Wars got canceled and Disney would acquire it, that they would probably have to immediately push out another Star Wars project, because it was highly rated cartoon that people love that was on Cartoon Network now is off the air. So they started developing The Force Awakens pretty quickly after the acquisition. And George had always had this idea of what he wanted the sequel trilogy to be. We kind of get a bit of the sequel trilogy-esque in the books. Like, we know what happens after Return of the Jedi for about, like, 150 years. There's just history. But he had his ideas. And so he, you know, was like, I want to help you guys make the sequel trilogy. And they started doing it. And they were like, George, your ideas kind of aren't good. So they pushed him. So they pushed him out of the process. And yeah, so that's where we end up now with The Force Awakens. Started filming in about 2014. So I had a really quick turnaround rate for not only pre-production, but filming and post. Had a budget of $447 million and ended up bringing in the box office over $2 billion.
Holy night! That is crazy bananas right there. I did not know it was that successful.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, you got to think about, there's, at this time, like, Marvel is really big. It's kind of in its prime at Disney.
Yeah.
So I think there were very high expectations for Disney on this production. Clearly, with that big ass budget, to think that the original movie, I mean, they were broke as shit. And basically, we're just using cardboard cutouts and was just making shit out of, like, leftover equipment. And that's why, like, a lot of, like, lightsabers themselves, they're actually based off of, like, a part of a camera that holds up, like, the flash on old cameras. It's the tube.
Okay.
And so that's what, like, Luke's lightsaber is. So shit like that, where they just did not have money and they were doing whatever they could. But clearly with this movie, they had money. And there was a bunch of promotion before the movie came out, and Disney tried really hard to kind of catch us up on the lore really quickly. So before the movie came out, we at least knew that there was this thing called the First Order that had kind of taken over the galaxy. We didn't really know that much about where our, like, main characters were, but it had been heavily rumored and then eventually confirmed that the main cast was coming back. So people were like, okay, like, it's still the Skywalker trilogy. So we're going to see the Skywalkers. But when the first trailers came out and people saw, like, John Boyega, everyone was like, who the hell is this guy? but yeah, it came out and pretty positive reception. Of course, my biggest beef is how they treated Kylo Ren. So, before I get on that tangent, what are your thoughts with the movie? What'd you think?
Well, I will say, I remember when it came out and how people's minds were blown by the fact that the old cast was in the new one. Especially Carrie Fisher. Like, that was, people lost their shit. But then, at the end of the movie, when we see Luke Skywalker, played by Mark Hamill, I just remember being in the movie theater and people like going just bonkers. Oh, yeah. Like, it was crazy. I think, and it's funny because I actually remember that more than my initial reactions to the movie when we actually went and saw it in the movie theater. It just brings home how much people, especially in my generation, so people who were born in the 70s and 80s, really identify with these movies, even though there's like no way you can identify with them because they're literally in outer space. But how emotionally connected and invested people are. And that's what's so funny about the whole Kylo Ren controversy is when I watch these three movies, which I see them as one basically big movie, I become very emotionally invested in the characters, like how the old school Star Wars fans are emotionally invested in the characters of the prequels. So it doesn't make sense to me that people are like, these aren't any good, they're not the originals or whatever. I'm like, are you crazy? These are phenomenal. As you know, I recently came to visit you not that long ago out in Denver. And I actually watched or rewatched The Force Awakens on my flight there and took copious notes throughout the film of just such, the script is so like, oh, so good. Like there's some lines in it. Like the first thing I wrote down was, why are you always trying to hold my hand?
Yeah.
Do you remember that scene? It's the scene with Rey and Finn, and he's constantly trying to hold it. Like, he's constantly trying to be, like, the guy, even though he had never been around that kind of situation where he had to be a protector of, like, the damsel in distress. He immediately got into that mode of, well, I've got to protect Rey. I've got to make her do what I want her to do. And she's like, motherfucker, I don't need your help. Like, I've been out here on my own all of my life, and you're trying now to tell me what to do? So I just, it's so good. I love this movie. I love it. So sue me. I love it.
Well, that's good. I think what really gets people is probably the really strong characterizations right off the bat. Because if you think about, so like our four big characters, so Kylo, Rey, Finn, and Poe. The first time you meet Poe, you're immediately very aware of, like, okay, he's some sort of, like, resistance pilot, and that's, like, an off-branch of, like, the rebellion back from the original trilogy, and he seems very, like, assured of himself and very confident and kind of fits that archetype of what the rebels were viewed as back in the original trilogy. And then to have Kylo come in, and immediately you're like, okay, we're getting a dark force user, we're getting someone who is very cold and is very driven, because clearly he just kills Lars Santeca, the old guy, like immediately. He's got a bit of like a sense of humor, almost like he's enjoying what he's doing.
Yes, there's like this one line I wrote down where it's, women always figure out the truth. I don't remember what scene that was, but I thought it was hysterical. I think he
Han,
said it, right?
Han says it to Finn.
Oh, that's right.
I mean,
right.
Clearly,
sorry.
Like, you know, like father, like son.
Yes.
Like there's a bit of this like dry humor to Kylo that I really enjoy, because it's a very interesting idea of having your villain almost revel in the misery that he's causing. And then halfway into the movie, showing us how broken he is and how manipulated he's been by Snoke. And you know, that's such a divergence from typical villains in these kind of epic operas like this. And I think that might have just been, it's not anything about Adam Driver's performance. I think it's probably one of the best performances in a movie that I've seen him in the sequel trilogy. I do think it's a bit of the perception that a lot of fans have of how the Star Wars formula, if you will, of he doesn't fit that Vader archetype. And I think it was really refreshing to see someone like Kylo who showed so much vulnerability. And it really made you question, why is he doing this? With Vader, it seemed in the original trilogy that, you know, it was just about power and just about taking over the galaxy. And then we finally get to Return of the Jedi, and then we started learning, like, okay, like, no, he's just a man. And that he's still human because...
with a severe mental illness.
Yeah, Vader needs to...
You know what I mean? Like, he is mentally unstable, and that's what's driving a lot of those decisions he's making.
Yeah, but, like, the hope that, you know, he could be turned back to life, back to good by his son, it shows you that he's human. And, of course, then we have the prequel trilogy that takes us even a step further into the development of Vader. And so it's very easy to see why people consider Anakin Skywalker to be the most important character in the Skywalker trilogy. Because if you think about the prequel as the fall of Anakin Skywalker, the original trilogy as the redemption of Vader and the redemption of Anakin Skywalker, and then now you see the sequels as the legacy of those two entities. I think we can figure out real quick that Kylo is my number one Star Wars man. I love him so much. Did you know that?
Yes. Yes. I knew that. And I'm not sure... No, I'm going to say it's a healthy obsession that you have with Kylo Ren. You, as we've talked about in previous episodes, we have talked about stalking and drawing the line between just fan being a good fan and stalking a certain actor, which you've always respected that kind of boundary, which is great. But would you absolutely give up everything you own and possibly murder your family if you could have the chance to go and be in a Star Wars movie and meet Kylo Ren for real?
Oh, absolutely.
There's not even a
I was like, if the trade-off is, yeah, drop every, like, disappear, like, without a trace, disappear, sell everything, cut off contact with everyone to meet him, like meet Adam Driver? No.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've rehearsed what I would say to him. And every time I think about it, or like I would recite it, I'd start getting choked up. So I would be hysterical. And I don't really want to embarrass myself in front of him. I do know, however, since I have 3 Kylo Ren tattoos, I do know that he's seen one of them, because a friend of mine who I worked with at theme parks went up to New York to go see him on Broadway. And at the stage door, for some reason, they were like, hey, my friend has a tattoo of Kylo Ren.
No way.
Yeah, so shout out Kathleen. What a homie.
So Kathleen!
He knows I exist because he's seen my skin. But
putting Adam Driver aside, if you had the opportunity to actually be in the Kylo Ren scene, though, let's be clear, you'd do anything to get to that. Right. Like, if that was a possibility.
Yes.
Okay.
Just,
yeah. Like I said, I'm not surprised. I'm the one that brought
exactly.
it up. So.
I'd be thinking of y'all while I did it.
Oh, yeah. I know you wouldn't, you liar. Be like, that stupid bitch ain't here. I don't have to worry about her anymore. Doing a damn podcast to educate her on my life.
Love you.
All right. So back to Force Awakens. You had mentioned how just damaged Kylo Ren is and how you recognize that. It's very interesting to me, and I was most perplexed between him, his relationship between Kylo Ren and the Weasley brother. What was his name?
General Hux.
How do you spell that?
H-U-X.
Oh, because throughout the whole movie, I'm like, what the hell are they saying? So then I just was like, the Weasley brother. That whole relationship is very interesting to me. Not just because the Weasley brother is so whiny. Like, I just want to, like, smack him the whole time. But, like, Kylo's just off on his own thing. Like, he's off on his own mission. He's dealing with Snoke in his own way. Like, it's his own... It's, I guess, like the CIA and the FBI, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're just totally doing different things, and screw you and whatever you're up to, because I've got my own plan. And so I wasn't sure, like, what was behind all that? Like, how did Kylo be, how did he get to the point where he was just like, you know what, fuck you guys, I'm going to do what I want?
Well, it's just like, if you think about, like, the parallel between Snoke, Kylo, and General Hux, to maybe Emperor Palpatine, Darth Vader, and then we could argue, like, Tarkin from A New Hope. The goal of Palpatine and Vader's partnership was purely for Sith reasons. So a master and apprentice. So Palpatine would gain as much power as he possibly could, not only to conquer the galaxy, because if you think about it, that's the ultimate power that the Sith hunger for. But Vader kind of acts as his, almost his, like, guard dog. Kind of does his, like, dirty work. Vader himself does not, he's not really involved with the Empire. He's been sent on, like, missions by Palpatine, where he's, like, representing the Empire. But he's kind of like the man, the myth, the legend within the Empire of, like, oh shit, Vader's coming. Because he's not like a politician. He's clearly just going to be, if he's there, it means something's bad and someone's probably going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tarkin was always the goal-focused, very ambitious, very hungry person that was willing to do whatever it took to advance the goals of the Empire. So fully indoctrinated, had been working with Palpatine since the days of the Republic to basically build the framework for the Empire to flourish in. So then if you view that kind of relationship with the sequel trilogy villains, you know, Snoke obviously takes the place of Palpatine, Kylo takes the place of Darth Vader, and General Hux replaces Tarkin. It's the same thing where Hux is the highest military officer for the First Order, which is characterized as a militaristic regime. Like, that's what it's based off of. So it's different than the Empire, because the Empire still had, like, a government and had the Senate and still kind of had a governmental structure. The First Order is not about that. So it's purely military. So Kylo, from what we know and what has been revealed to us, once again, has no stake in the First Order. None. Because his goal with Snoke is to eliminate the Jedi, who are the only threat at this point that can, because it brought down the Empire. 30 years ago, so it could happen again. Yeah, like their bickering relationship is interesting because Vader and Tarkin had a very high respect for each other. Very professional. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there's in the New Hope, Tarkin's like, Vader, please don't kill this man. And Vader's like, as you wish.
I guess I'll listen.
But I think it's interesting to look at Kylo's relationship with Hux, because me being me and knowing everything about the life of Ben Solo, you have to think, like, if you're one of the few in the First Order that knows who Kylo Ren actually is, knows that he's Ben Solo, which only, like, the highest of the high within the organization know that. His name is attached to the greatest Jedi in the galaxy, the leader of the rebellion, and a senator for the Republic, and the famous war hero and smuggler, Han Solo. So he has, you know, this legacy that he comes from, and yet he doesn't really... He cares about it because it is his overarching drive of why he does the things he does to be like Vader. But there's not really a benefit for him in having this past. What we know about Hux is that his father was one of the few Imperial officers who fled into the unknown regions after Return of the Jedi, and basically had a son, who he considered like a bastard, and developed the new stormtrooper program, which basically, instead of conscripted soldiers, it was, we're just going to brainwash children into being soldiers so they're completely loyal to what will be the First Order. So Hux has just been this manipulated child who clearly does not have a great father. And even from, like, his, you know, some would say, like, humble beginnings of being viewed as a bastard, he's now the highest level of the First Order. So I could see where he could be really pissed off by someone like Kylo, who isn't really helping the First Order achieve their goal of domination. Like, has all this power, but he chooses not to use it for the goals that Hux believes are true. So, like, I get it. I think I do have a problem with Hux's character, like, just how J.J. Abrams ended up treating Hux in Rise of Skywalker, which we'll talk
about. Well, yeah, because...
Yeah.
I was going to say, now I feel bad for him. And I'm so glad you shared that, because it really does... I mean, he is... The characterization of him is very whiny. In my opinion, he seemed very whiny. But now I'm like, well, no wonder, because he's like overcome so much to get to this point. And you're telling me you've got this other guy who's coming from this rich, you know, richy rich kind of family who's turning his back on them. And you want me to trust you? Like, why would I trust you? Interesting.
I feel like that's a lot of information that we start getting in novels leading up to The Last Jedi. So after Force Awakens, then we started getting a lot more information about these characters. And so, of course, we don't get a lot of this characterization in the movie. And I could see where a lot of people just write off immediately Kylo or Hux's behavior as whiny and pathetic and just, like, shit on it a lot. But, like, I would argue that Kylo is the star of this trilogy. If Vader's the star of the prequel trilogy and Luke's the star of the original, this is Ben's movie. Because if he is what Vader's legacy is supposed to be, it brings up a lot of really good, like, questions about... What is a legacy, like the ability to move on from your family's expectations and be your own person? And Kylo really struggles with this idea of, if I can kill every single link to who I was when I was born, who I'm supposed to be, then that person can just disappear. So you could see why he would be so hellbent on trying to find the map to Luke Skywalker, trying to destroy the rebellion. The resistance,
oh,
ending up killing his father, is because those are the three links to that legacy. And we know now that from the time Leia was pregnant with Kylo, was pregnant with Ben, Snoke had been manipulating him. So we know that he was basically in Ben's head since the moment he was born, just whispering these self-doubts and these ideas that his parents feared him and that no one understood him and they would never be able to understand what he's going through. But Snoke knows, you know, he understands that darkness, and he can see someone within Ben that can defy all these expectations that are put on him. And so, yeah, like, if you have this information about this character, and then you're introduced to a character like Rey, who is, you know, they frequently say it in these movies, you know, you come from nothing, you're nothing. Because at this point, The Force Awakens, we know that she's been on Jakku for a very long time, doesn't have any family, any friends, has this, you know, this dream that her family's going to come back and get her, that they're going to rescue her and save her. So, like, to have her thrown in the mix with Kylo in these movies, and they start building this idea of, like, a Force dyad, like a connection between the two of them. It's so well written, and it's acted so beautifully that's where I just get confused, because I'm like, why do people hate these characters?
I don't know, but you've, like, just blown my mind. It's finally happening, Finnig. You finally have made it all make sense to me. Like, all of the movies before this point, why Kylo is going after everybody. I really didn't understand why he killed his dad, but it makes so much sense. Like you said, he's trying to break off every link he had to the person he was before. And I wonder if that's why he feels so connected to Rey, because she has nothing. And he almost wishes he was as lucky, air quotes, as Rey is, because she has no family. Her family sold her, abandoned her. Like, to Kylo, that's like the dream, right? To not have any genetic, emotional, or physical baggage like he has. So it's, I know we've talked about this before, the use of Asian philosophy throughout the Star Wars, but it's a very yin and yang balance between the two of them, because without the other, they'll never be whole, right? They need each other to be complete. And so my mind is blown. Thank you.
You're welcome. And you bring up a great idea about the yin and yang, which really comes into play in Last Jedi and Rise of Skywalker. So I can't wait for us to talk about that with the other films. But I could see, like, going back to the movie itself, I could see why people, you know, shit on it. It is very similar in format to A New Hope, which I think that's kind of the point of, like, you know, history is bound to repeat itself, that these regimes that come into power will eventually disappear and be replaced by another. There will always be a group. that is striving for democracy and justice. And there will always be people that are caught in the middle of that. But there's something just so, like, it's just a beautiful film. It's got an amazing cast. It's definitely one of my, like, favorite John Williams scores. Like, there's some songs and scores in that movie that he just, I feel like he's just been sitting on for, like, 20 years. It was like, all right, like, I can't wait to bust this out if there's ever another Star Wars movie. But yeah, it definitely set very high expectations for The Last Jedi, which I do think was a bit of its own downfall. Because once we talk about The Last Jedi, we'll talk about, like, the weird perception that people have about that movie and just how there's such a strong dislike for it. But I would argue it's the best Star Wars film. For reasons to be...
Agreed.
Yeah, for reasons to be discussed. But still, like, yeah, like, this is... I love watching this movie. Every time I watch it, I kind of learn something new about the characters. It really builds out this really interesting idea with Finn and his relationship to the Force, which... They don't really touch on The Last Jedi, but then they just bring back, for some reason, Rise of Skywalker.
I will say, if I can interject, the bromance between Finn and Poe, it's a lot for me to handle. I enjoy it to a point, and then I'm like, we need to tone this shit down. Like, it's too much. It's too distracting. I feel like it... The other Star Wars movies always had, like, a vein of campiness through it, you know? And I felt like maybe J.J. Abrams and the other writers were like, well, we got to have some camp in this movie, and we'll make it between Finn and Poe. Like, it was a lot. A lot.
I get that. I do know that, like, Poe's character was supposed to die after the escape from the Star Destroyer. So pretty early in the movie. But basically, Oscar Isaac was just such a charismatic person and actor and really cared about the character to the point that J.J. Abrams was like, yeah, you can come back. Like, you can be alive.
Yeah, I was confused there. I'm pretty sure he was really dead. But that's okay. There's a lot of other resurrections throughout the trilogy. So I can't, like, complain about this one because Oscar Isaac is pretty cute. So... Well, in the time we have left, can we go through a couple other questions that I had in the movie? Why does everyone want to go to Jakku? Like, what is it about Jakku that makes it so freaking desirable? Like, everybody's going to Jakku. It's like Vegas. Like, everybody's got to go there at least once. What's the deal with Jakku?
I mean, like, it's still just like a... I mean, it's clearly a...
Trading
post?
Yeah,
it's clearly like a desert planet. The important, like, historical fact about it is that the Battle of Jakku was the last war fought with the rebellion in the Empire. So it takes place, like, a year after Return of the Jedi. And it's the last battle. That's why there's the Star Destroyers and all the ships and the Imperial Walker that Rey lives in. So it's important in that aspect. But, I mean, it's still just like a nothing planet. I'm just glad that it's not Tatooine. Because we've been to Tatooine too many times.
too many times. It's like going to Disney. When, you know, you'll go. You like going. But sometimes you got to go to Disneyland instead of Disney World. Just change of scenery. Okay, next question. How did Roz end up with Luke's lightsaber?
So we still kind of don't know that. We...
Like, did it just manifest itself there or something? I didn't understand
that.
No,
so we know that his lightsaber... In Empire Strikes Back, on the fight in Cloud City, you know, Vader wallops that hand off and the lightsaber falls. So then we know that it basically, that was like a trash chute that they like, that Luke ends up jumping into to escape. So we know that it gets picked up and then it kind of has like a very complicated history of like just transferring owner to owner. But yeah, that's still something that they haven't really explained. And I think it's one of those things where, I mean, Star Wars will give a stupid ass answer for any and every question. But then there's certain things that they're like, no, we're just gonna leave it as a little secret. And I honestly think this is gonna be one of those things.
Oh. Well, I didn't like it. So anyhow, here's a very important question I have for you. And I'm literally going to read this verbatim. How many pew-pews are in a gun?
So, there's an ash.
Explain the guns to me.
So,
because they have a lot of pew-pews. And it's like, is it an endless supply of pew-pews? Or are they just reloading and we don't see them? Like, explain.
So there's a like movie answer, which is obviously just we are led to believe that this is like an endless supply. Because I think maybe they're like, yeah, in the future, like they don't have to reload their weapons. Like they're self-sustaining, you know, like some stupid nerd shit like that. But then for some reason, we know this from Republic Commando, the video game that came out for the Clone Wars, and then we know from like the Republic Commando books, which it's all clone related, so of course I had to read it. That's like the first mention that there's actually like cartridges and that they do have to reload the weapons. So, to really answer your question, it's just like with a normal gun. It depends on the gun, how many cartridges you can hold, how, like, the plasma, like, how much of the plasma there is in it. Then there's different types of guns, because some guns or some blasters use different, like, materials.
Oh, sorry. Are they not guns? They're not guns. Yeah, they're blasters. Am I saying this wrong? Does somebody like roll over and die when I said
probably
guns to begin
with?
Just
I think
sorry,
if you know English and you have a brain, I think you can figure out how similar the two are and be like, yeah. But yeah, they're called blasters. So yeah, say they
Blaster.
Yeah, so to answer your question, they actually can be reloaded. You can run out. And they do overheat. So it's like a normal American-made gun.
Great. Let's see here. I did write down how much I loved the lightsaber fight between Rey and Kylo towards the end, especially when they freaking slice trees in half. Are you kidding me? Like, that whole scene, for those of you who don't know, I'm a freak for kung fu movies, and that is so, that whole scene just reeks of like 1960s kung fu. Like, it is just beautiful, the whole scene.
Yeah, which like that's the whole thing with Star Wars, it's based off of like samurai movies, so Kurosawa films, and going on this idea of the Ronin. Like, that's a huge part of Star Wars. And so it's nice when there's moments like that where Star Wars kind of remembers where it came from, and it makes and pause and be like, oh, this is a film. Like, you get so immersed in the world, and then there'll be moments where there's kind of film references or references to like actual regimes that have existed or actual political military events that have happened. And you're like, oh shit. Like, George Lucas was just viewing the world around him. And then just for some reason was like, well, what if
it was space?
Oh my God. What a treasure. What a national treasure he is. Finally, my last question is, why is it so important to find Luke Skywalker? Like, you explained to me, like, Kylo's perspective, right? That he's trying to cut off every link he had to his ancestral past, I guess. But everybody wants to find Luke. Like, clearly the man does not want to be found. And so it kind of gave me a different perspective when, you know, the scene where he actually, like, turns around and looks at Rey. I bet he was like, son of a bitch. Like, I have done everything to stay away from you people, and you find me again. Do you think he isolated himself because of what we would eventually learn is the relationship between him and Ben? Or does he really see himself as a threat to the universe? Like, why did he isolate himself, in your opinion? And why was it so important for everybody to find him? Because everybody's looking for him. It's not just Kylo. It was like everyone on both sides.
Yeah, so I think you were right with both of the points you brought up. But then there's also a third point, which is this idea of legends. And, you know, in the Empire, the Jedi had been wiped out. Like, Darth Vader and his Inquisitors made it very obvious that they were still hunting any remaining Jedi that didn't, you know, get killed in Order 66. Because Order 66 took out 90% of the Jedi in the galaxy. So there's still that 10% that could theoretically cause a big problem. And, you know, that's a risk that Palpatine and Vader are not willing to allow for them to reorganize and to grow. So you have to snuff it out. And that's what Snoke brings up, is, especially in The Last Jedi, brings up this idea that Luke Skywalker, who is viewed by the galaxy as the one who, you know, killed Vader, killed Palpatine, freed the galaxy from the tyrannical empire, he has now been elevated to these impossible standards. He's a legend now. But with that comes this idea that he can solve everyone's problems. So it's, you could see from a resistance sort of New Republic standpoint of, you know, the legendary Luke Skywalker, Jedi Master, he saved us then, he can save us now, from the First Order. From Leia's perspective, all she knows realistically is she sent her son to train at Luke's academy. And then the next thing she knows after a couple years of training is Luke has disappeared. His training temple has burned to the ground, and his son is nowhere to be. Her son is nowhere to be found. So she's trying to get a lot of answers of what exactly happened. How did Ben turn to the dark side? And I also think it shows how human Leia is as a character, because even though she's now the leader of the resistance and has these expectations put on her shoulders once again, she just cares about him as her brother. And I think there's that side. And then, of course, we have the First Order's viewpoint, which, I mean, since the First Order is basically just the Empire 2.0, of any Jedi that are allowed to exist instill this idea of hope. And hope is a very dangerous thing. And I think if you're the First Order, where you've kind of learned from your mistakes with the Empire, where the Empire was very calculated and was very sneaky with how it kind of gained power. And it took place just over, 30 years, before the Empire even became in existence. It was in play. Now you have the First Order, who doesn't really have the time to spare. They are just ready to burn the galaxy down to the ground, to eliminate any of their threats so they can fully gain power. It's not about gaining loyalty anymore. It's about complete domination. So Luke Skywalker represents this idea of hope and justice that the First Order really can't afford to let exist. And that's where then it's really helpful that you have someone like Kylo, who kind of has some beef with Luke Skywalker, who's so hungry to find this man. I could see where not only just Luke knowing what happened that night at the training temple, but knowing the expectations that were put on Anakin as the chosen one, and obviously how that led to be like the evolution of Darth Vader. I think Luke is very aware the power that legends have in a society, and also the dangers. And yeah, like he brings up the Last Jedi of like, to Rey, he's like, what do you think I'm gonna do? Like, take a laser sword and fight the entire First Order? Like, that's not how reality works. And I think that's interesting because if you think of the original trilogy as, made for kids, because it was, that's a concept that we don't usually show in children's media. Of like, be realistic. One man can't fight a government. And I think that's for something like this, where it's for people that, like your generation, grew up with the original trilogy, now have children who are going to be seeing this film. It's kind of a wake-up call of like, even to the own fan base, of being like, yeah, this legend of Luke Skywalker that our society has made, he's just a man. And he has flaws. And that makes him, it just makes him so. And I think that's a really interesting take with the sequel trilogies. It kind of shows us the folly of a lot of these original trilogy characters, especially knowing that like Han and Leia, they separate because of what happens between Luke and Ben, that they end up separating. Like, yeah, like they, we expect our heroes to have a happy ending. But I think there's something about Star Wars that's always been very steeped in reality. And it's very adamant of the cycle will keep continuing if you continue to act a certain way. So does that kind of make sense? It's a very like philosophical topic that for some reason is like only present in The Last Jedi, and then they're just like, never. That's too much thinking for a movie.
Well, I will say he also looked pretty cute with his long hair. So
yeah.
For us old school people, I was like, damn, son, you look good.
Yeah, I was never I've said it on a previous episode. I was never like a Luke Skywalker obsessed person.
Me neither.
But I think that's why I like him in the sequel trilogy, is because he's been broken down into just a man. And he has to live with the consequences of his legacy, similar to Ben, but he's been put in a terrible position of doing one right thing for the galaxy. Now he's expected to do everything. I could see why, you know, if you have these expectations on your shoulders like Ben did, but then you've had someone in your head your entire life being like, they don't think you can do it. Like, it's such such good conflict. So it makes these characters more interesting, and it makes you excited for The Last Jedi. Because then at this point, there's 2 years before The Last Jedi comes out. So it's a lot of time for, like, speculation and, you know, like, oh, like, what's going to happen? Like, Rey found Luke Skywalker. Is he going to train her? Blah, blah, blah. And especially because in between The Force Awakens, Last Jedi, we get Rogue One, which is like a nice palate cleanser. So then, like, when you come back, you're like, oh shit, like, we're gonna find out, like, what happened. And then that's why. But we'll talk about that next episode.
Well, like I said, you have once again blown my mind. I finally feel like I've gotten it, and I was really excited to watch it. And I'm excited to keep going, because I'm really excited about these last two movies. I've watched them before, and I love them.
Oh, so. Yeah. Well, of course, like, you can watch The Last Jedi normal on Disney Plus. But if you're feeling a little spicy, on Disney Plus, there's a version of The Last Jedi where there's no audio, no sound effects. It is just the John Williams score. So that means there's periods of time in the movie where it's silent. But yeah, it blows my... I watch it all the time. So.
I was going to say, I'm going to let you have that. That's going to be yours. That's not going to be mommy's. So I'll just watch it regular styles.
Okay. I'll allow it.
Well, thank you. Well, thanks again for spending some time with your mommy.
You're welcome. I love it.
Good. Well, until next time.
May the Force be with you.
And also with you.
Bye.